What's up, sports fans? Welcome to another episode of Sports Odds and Ends. I'm one of your hosts, King Cash, joined as always by my good friend and co-host, the one, the great, JVZ. What is up, my guy?
Things are going pretty well. I know we were a little late on this episode, but that's because we intentionally waited until after the World Series is over to record this. So
yeah, we wanted to see who was going to win, and we wanted to see if people were going to act a fool, and both happened.
Yeah, we'll get into that later. At least upcoming this weekend, we've got the League of Legends World Championship for 2020, which I guess I'm glad they were able to at least still have this tournament despite all the COVID issues going around. So good for them.
I'm not gonna lie, right? I paid attention long enough to watch NA be shit, good rant about that, I think, already, and I'm not gonna do it again, I promise. But you know, I think it's come down to what it supposed to. We also watched EU just get slapped in those last few rounds, which is now making everyone question the way anyone who's not Korea and China plays League. But we're also on like kind of the edge of a big change coming in League of Legends, because there's going to be a lot of gameplay changes, kind of, in a sense, since they're doing a really big overhaul of the items. And just really quick, if you don't understand League, you kind of itemize the characters that you play to make them stronger as the game goes on. So they're doing a really big overhaul to that. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that goes and how that changes the landscape of play, because everybody is going to have to get used to new items in the game. Well, not new items, but reclassified items in the game.
Yeah. So every time there's a rule change in any sport, everybody has to adjust to it. So maybe this will tip the balance of power a little bit.
No.
But yeah, probably not. EU had a good run a couple years where it looked like they were closing the gap. Looked like NA was not that far behind them. It's really hard to compete with these Korean and Chinese teams. Damwon Gaming and Suning are competing in the finals on Saturday. Or I think that might be Saturday our time. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like the... Friday night into Saturday morning. That's during that overnight. That's when you can check out this final. It'll be a best of five. I think normally for these, they do like a big opening ceremony as well. So with some really cool augmented reality special effects. I think a couple of years ago they did a badass dragon. They also usually release some music videos that go along with this too.
They're still stuck on their pop phase thing with their KDA thing that they're doing. So we're just going to get more of that. And it's
I think it's cool because it's like, they're finding multiple ways to market this this event, this game, which usually costs them a lot to hold. So
yeah,
I think it's a further indication of the health of the sport in general. And if you want to check out high level League of Legends, check out the final this week, or check out a replay of it, because if you're not going to wake up at 3 a.m. Pacific to watch this. On the North American side, I think Bombshell was kind of dropped this week with Bjergsen, TSM's mid laner, for the last 6 years, is now chosen to retire from playing and become TSM's new head coach.
Which essentially mean he's done, but they're going to keep paying him.
Head coach.
Because we've talked about this ad nauseum on this show, how coaches and managers and all of these people who mean so much to other sports mean very little to esports. Like coaching in esports is, I feel like it should have a bigger role, but it just doesn't. Players don't really tend to, or from my knowledge, right? Cause I have a very secondary knowledge of these things, but from a lot of what I've taken in and learned is that role is kind of just a cushy role. You're mostly there to manage team compositions and like what the other team kind of likes to do for ban phases and things like that. But as far as it goes for kind of game in-game things, it's usually down to one of the players on the team who is kind of been gifted that IGL or that in-game leader role, shot caller role. But this is another one of those things that for me kind of always pushes that really weird part of my brain when it comes to esports, because he's 24 and yeah. A lot of the things that people are writing are like, oh yeah, you know, Bjergsen's been in the sport for a long time and it's kind of time for him to maybe look at some other options and things and stuff like that. And just in my head, as like a person who is very, you know, I follow so much sports. 24 is when you're starting to hit your prime in most sports. So
unless you're a gymnast.
Yeah.
But like that's, yeah, it's weird to think of like, okay, esports and gymnastics, those are the but even the types of sports where you age out at 24.
Yeah, even in gymnastics though, it's usually because, you know, you're hitting your career stride at, you know, 14 and 15 because you've been doing it since you were 8 or 9. Whereas like esports, you start sometimes when you're 14 15, but like it's still not the lengthiest careers, you know what I mean? Like he's been with TSM for 6 years, but I think kind of officially as a professional player, and obviously he's been playing before that, it's been about 8-ish years, which is still not like a lengthy sports career. You know what I mean? And not even comparing it to like the highest mark, which is like a LeBron James who's sitting at 17 years and probably going to play for another 3 or 4, unless he can get his the NBA to agree to let his son come out of high school. You know, it's just, I don't know, man. It's just so weird to see somebody retire at 24 and that be the norm.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a reminder that this is still a very young sport. Because he is, I would say, like every sport kind of has their figureheads where this is the person that's been on this team since as long as I can remember. And so Bjergsen has been the TSM mid laner for as long as I can remember. You know, that one guy that just never changes teams despite everybody else moving around. He is that guy. But it's still only been 6 years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, his team change was a big thing because he went from one region to another. So DJM asked the question, is it a bad idea for him to coach the team? Him coaching the team, no matter what happens, like whether they continue to do poor or they do great, none of that accolade goes to him, no matter what. It literally means nothing. It literally, you coaching an esports team is just a check mark on your resume of nothingness. If you're not a player and if you're not an owner, you really mean nothing.
But you could really say that about most sports. So
Kaz is trying to say it means even less, because I think there are even more figureheads and less strategic drivers than they are in other sports. I want to say that for North American League of Legends, that kind of seems to be the case because the teams get new coaches and throw away old coaches just like all the time. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Cloud9 was kind of the exception to that because Reaper, who they did just recently fire as well, it seemed like he was instrumental in training up a lot of their young players. But they were kind of the only team that did that, that like actually had a legitimate academy system and, you know, promoted people from the academy system. And they were just churning out like new MVPs left and right. And I think like you can't really do that without coaching, mm-hmm. without no, like, a legitimate coaching and scouting system.
I think if you really, really, really gave the reins to somebody who had the mindset to do it and you could get your players to focus on a certain amount of things and you can focus and you could have that person focus on strategy and
all right, guys, Kaz, VZ, like I want to ask you something because you've brought this up a few times with esports and coaching, mm-hmm. and how the coaches don't mean anything. Mm-hmm. Why is it that, is it a, how do I put this? Is it because the coaches don't mean anything because of the players? Is it the players just not listening to coaches? Why is this a problem?
It's a column A, column B thing, right? So column A is, it is there because essentially they're still trying to find those roles to fulfill, to kind of emulate ball sports. And then B, it is a thing on the players, right? A lot of players, when I realized coaches didn't mean anything, was this kind of big thing that came out of Counter-Strike, and League of Legends got wrapped up in it too, where they were talking to players about coaches, and like kind of unanimously, a lot of the players were like, they're just kind of there, dude. Like they don't know because they don't play, right? And some of these coaches,
what if it is someone that played for a long time and played at a high level?
So a lot of it was in that transition from esports of old to esports of now, right? Where it was these teams that were made up of people who came together playing the game, made a team, moved up, da 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 da, and then you had these kids who came up in these ingrown systems of joining the team, training to play for the team. They kind of looked at coaches as like, oh, well, you don't really know how the game works anymore. Like,
but what if it's someone that does, like someone that has played the game for a long time? It can play at a high level, does understand the game at a high level, and they just transition to another job on the team.
So,
because that's what this story sounds like.
Yeah, yes. that's
exactly what it is.
And for most of his teammates, they'll take that, but as soon as he is generally, and I'm not saying this is how TSM is going to go, but this is kind of how the landscape has gone. Generally, as they start to switch players and there's some of these young players, they're going to look at them and be like, well, if you could do it, you would do it. So why should I listen to you? Because that's kind of been the mindset the past 4 or 5 years in esports.
Yeah. I mean, I want to emphasize again that this is still like a young sport. So I think we're still kind of in the growing pains phase. And I think it'll be less now than.
But who am I going to listen to? A guy that played the game for 10 years or a guy that played for 2?
Right. I think the point you're kind of getting at is that, like, you know, where is the coaching pool coming from if not from former players? And I think you're right about that. Like, this is what's going to have to make up this pool, but it is getting deeper and deeper. And so I think maybe like our objections to him becoming a coach is that he's kind of become a coach like right away, a head coach right away. And it's kind of the same objections I have to like other sports as well, when they just kind of immediately announce a former player as a head coach without them ever having been an assistant for anybody else before. And so like at the same time, it's like he does have the clout to demand respect now. He you know, has the strategic mind of having been in the sport for a long time. He has the relatability of having played recently. All these things point to the fact that he should be at least serviceable as a coach. But TSM is a team, and it's a roster built right now that is, you know, it was a team that was built to have world championship success, which is something that he's never had. I guess they've been built with that intention, even though they've never actually quite hit that point. So it's, you know, the best coaches in North America so far, at least the most successful as coaches, have been the ones that have come from Korean or Chinese teams that have had success and then have brought like their strategy and training mindsets to the United States or to North America. I think we're going to slowly get away from, you know, these head coaches as figurehead positions where you give where you need to find a role for these guys who are retiring. I think now it's starting to get to the point where like there's only so many of these jobs available, and so you need to be good at this now. So I don't know, like I half feel like the way Kaz feels, but I also feel like that landscape is changing, and I think like Bjergsen have the potential to change that landscape, but ultimately we don't know a lot about how he coaches because he hasn't coached before. He's just the quarterback that you just assume is going to end up being a good coach one day, or the point guard that you assume is going to be a good coach one day because they were the quote unquote coach on the field.
And those are two, but the thing is, as we know, in the relation to real sports, those are two totally different things. You know what I mean? Like being in the game and saying, hey guys, let's do this, as opposed to being outside of the game and saying, this is what you guys need to do to win, is very drastically different. And if you don't have the makeup to make that happen, and especially kind of still with some of the toxicity that existed in esports, they put those guys in those positions. There have been teams who have gone, yo, this is the guy. We need to listen to him because he knows what he's talking about. And then you see a report from one of the ESPN or any of these other things where they're like, well, the coach got moved because this player didn't want to listen to him, and they want to keep that player.
Or the coach still in this landscape. Was a toxic personality. Yeah. And
we're still
and
in
they
this
only
landscape
gave him that job
where...
because he was famous or because he's, you know, meant a lot to the team. But I don't know. Bjergsen doesn't come across as that kind of person. So
no, but the problem is we still live in a landscape where the players will always still have more power. You know what I mean? It's not as even or skewed as it is in some other sports, but it's one of those things. It is changing. Like you said, Cloud9 is kind of a good show of what having that good power structure of good team management, good coaching, good player progression is, where you have these guys that you can kind of move around like they do in Korea. They're like, hey, he's not really performing this week. Let's bring this other guy up and do that. It's moving, but right now it's still a like, oh hey, we still respect you and want to kind of give you money for another few years. So
DJ says maybe they should try yelling. I think they do plenty of that. And that's kind of on the Cloud9 point, they just promoted Rain over to head coach, and he's a guy who's had problems getting along with teammates, I believe. So you know, things may be that tradition with them might change quite a bit with their recent changes. All right, so let's move on to another well-oiled machine when it comes to teams, the Mercedes Racing team, specifically Lewis Hamilton, who has now broken the record for most race wins ever, or for most Formula One Grand Prix wins. He won his 92nd race last weekend. at Portugal, and so that is one more than Michael Schumacher. I think that Schumacher record was one that people thought might never be broken. But then, you know, along comes Lewis Hamilton, and he has a great 6-year run where, you know, the best driver on the grid happens to also race for the best team on the grid. And so I think he's won, Mercedes has won 75% of races since then, and then Hamilton's won like 50% of races. So it's just a tremendous run. Even for this season, Mercedes looks set to capture their 7th title next week. Hamilton is going to probably wrap up the Drivers' Championship the week after. Another tremendous run in the turbo hybrid era, which is what they're calling it.
So when you get into deep runs like this in any sport, right, I think the question always becomes, is it still fun, right, to watch somebody do it like this much? Or does at some point it become one of those things where you're like, what is wrong with everyone else?
I think DJM mentions the Patriots. I think that's not quite the same because they've lost a couple Super Bowls. I think your Giants have been a big part of that. But it's still fun watching in a situation like that. It's just mildly annoying when the evil empire does end up winning again. And I think the same has kind of been true of the Golden State Warriors for the 5 seasons prior to this. If they were going to lose, they were going to lose in the finals. But there isn't really a finals in Formula One. It's just, you know, accumulating points throughout the season. So Lewis Hamilton has been on top. He's wrapped up the Drivers' Championship, usually a couple races before the end of the season. It does kind of seem boring, except for one year when his teammate was his biggest competitor and his teammate actually managed to beat him in 2016, I believe. From reading through the Formula One subreddit, it does feel very much like everybody is just wishing somebody could compete with this guy. Mm-hmm. Because he's not an asshole. Most people seem to respect him, so there's not a lot of hate, but there's just a little bit of annoyance that this one person has been there so long. Ferrari was supposed to, which is like the story, the team with the most history in Formula One, like they were supposed to be somewhat competitive the last couple of years, and then they've kind of shit the bed. So a lot of people are just mad at them. A lot of people are mad at Red Bull for being the next closest, but not having two drivers that can compete with them, only having one. I think everybody has gotten used to it and they've learned to find joy in the competition for third and fourth place, or to look at the midfield and understand that there's competitive battles going on there and to not worry so much about what's happening at the top. In fact, Netflix was able to do Drive to Survive season 1 without Mercedes or Ferrari being involved at all, outside of a couple seconds of clips saying, oh, hey, Lewis Hamilton won this race again. They were able to show that there are so many other stories going on without even having to mention those guys at all. And I think if you watch some of these races start to finish, there's a lot of like, okay, here's the first couple turns, and then the Mercedes cars are off and running, and then all right, now we don't have to watch them anymore. Like, let's go look at what's going on in the rest of the field, because those guys are just going to race among themselves. And then by the end of the first lap, I think we'll probably be able to tell which of those two cars is going to end up winning this race. And so I think everybody's eagerly waiting the newest regulation changes, the newest rule changes, to see how much of an effect they're going to have on Mercedes dominance. At the same time, you can't really blame Mercedes for continuing to just be good at what they do. So, I do think everybody is taking a what the hell is wrong with everybody else stance on this, because you can't really blame somebody for being excellent.
I mean, because that rule changes and things like that are kind of what killed the Jimmy Johnson dominance of NASCAR for the like 4-6 years that he kind of just was able to stay in the top of the standings for so long. So it's usually things like that. But I mean, you know more than I do, like kind of how drastic the rule changes can be for F1.
And they're going to be, they might not immediately be drastic, but it's going to be a cost cap. So, so a team like Mercedes cannot spend a shit ton of money on doing wind tunnel test after wind tunnel test and simulation after simulation and all that. There's going to be a cap to how much money they can spend on that stuff, which is money that they have because they're rich, because they keep winning. And so there's kind of this weird negative feedback loop that occurs for some of the small teams that can't compete with the bigger teams because they can't spend money on closing the gap between the big teams. So it'll be hopefully easier for some of those smaller teams to compete. On top of that, it'll hopefully be easier for newer teams to come in and be able to afford to stay in F1 without financially shitting the bed. So that's going to come not next year because there was a COVID delay, but the year afterwards. So we might start seeing the gap closing then. And that might be around the time Lewis Hamilton's might decide to hang up the boots, because he does say he wants to retire when he's still on top. So we might only be enjoying another season, or he technically does not have a contract for next year. But I think he's waiting for his coach to sign a contract. I think this is a very well managed team, so I think he wants to make sure Toto Wolff, the team principal of Mercedes, is around before he signs another contract as well. So I think they're just waiting for this season to either end or for them to wrap up the championships for this season before they settle that contract stuff. Whereas all the rest of the teams are shuffling around trying to line up drivers for next season as well. So Mercedes kind of avoids all that drama because they just keep winning. All right. One institution to another. Doc Emmerich is retiring from his role as kind of the, I would say, the voice of the NHL in North America, or at least the voice of the NHL in the United States. He's been calling games for 47 years. If you've watched hockey in the United States, you've heard this man's voice. Especially if you've been watching during the playoffs, he's been a mainstay on the NHL on NBC for the last 15 years. And even stretching further than that, he's called 22 Stanley Cup finals. So I think hockey is going to sound different next year. If you choose to watch more hockey, which Kaz and I are always encouraging people to do because it's always a fun sport to watch. And Doc Emmerich has been a big part of making hockey a fun experience and describing hockey in a very colorful way that that makes everybody feel excited. So kind of a sad day in broadcasting history. I think there's a lot of play-by-play broadcasters in other sports that have taken inspiration from Doc Emmerich. I've heard plenty of them talk in interviews about how Doc Emmerich is somebody that they've emulated themselves, that emulated their own calling style off of. So, so we always love to give love to the broadcasters here, the Joe Bucks of the world. They're a big part of making sports fun for the rest of us.
Yeah. I mean, it's the calls of sports are so ingrained in sports itself, like, because it is literally the birth of sports. Without somebody telling you what was happening in the game, I don't know if sports would be the same, right? Because there was no other way to relay that information other than the newspaper the next day. Like, so without like radio announcers back in the day, or somebody sitting on the side reporting what was happening, like, I don't know, sports wouldn't be what they are. So yeah, it's always great to have guys. And that's they decide to be there, but understand.
All right. Moving on to soccer, I think we've kind of been covering this Lionel Messi situation. He's been feuding with Barcelona. He's stuck with the team for one more season. People aren't too happy with the management of the team, or the front office management. Team president Josep Bartomeu has chosen to step down. I think they were on the cusp of doing like a no confidence vote, but I think he just assumed that that would be a no confidence vote, so he just wanted to save everybody the trouble of having to travel during COVID. So he just resigned. So I don't know if this makes them more likely or less likely to re-sign Lionel Messi. Maybe if the guy that he doesn't like is gone, maybe he'll sign. But maybe if maybe he's just intent on leaving. Maybe he was, maybe Bartomeu's insistence that he stays was the only thing keeping him here, not his insistence that he stays, but his refusal to sell him was the only thing keeping him here. And maybe we might see him move during the winter transfer window. But for now, it's some of the fallout on the wait and see on that situation.
I mean, yeah, I don't know, man. It's I've always kind of just lived on this thing that, like, if somebody's not happy, all you're going to do is cause more discomfort and happiness. And yes, he is a big name for them. Yes, he is a big selling commodity for them. But I feel like they would have so much money and freedom to be able to go out and get, you know, kind of the next person. And I know for, you know, a long time prior to this, a lot of people thought that was going to be Neymar, but, you know, Neymar moved on very early because he kind of knew his worth.
Well, and because PSG was willing to pay a shit ton of money to get him.
But it's just one of those things where I sometimes you just have to kind of move on to the next thing, because all you're going to just cause is more discomfort and dishappiness. And if you're really looking to actually play and compete, then I don't know, I think you're doing yourself more of a disservice in trying to keep the best player who isn't happy rather than go and finding a good player that might need some work.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those examples where players do ultimately have a lot of power, because if you have a superstar player and they've contributed so much to your team over so many years, you should feel an obligation to do right by their wishes, and just to at least maintain that relationship, because they deserve it because of everything they've given to the team, So, like, if they want to leave, then you, even though it kind of hurts your team, it's almost like you should feel obligated to let them do that. And if you don't, I think other players are going to look at you and see that if you choose to play hardball at the wrong time, even if you technically have like all the right to do so within the rules, within the law, then that's going to discourage other players from wanting to sign with you, because they know that when they end up in the same situation, you're going to do the same shitty thing to them. So it's ultimately, that's, you know, the teams that are very ruthless when it comes to transactional moves like that, the teams that like to say that it's just business all the time, eventually they get a reputation for being that kind of team. And so because of that, then I think it does eventually end up hurting their ability in the long run. The teams that get a reputation for doing right by their legends, they tend to have a little bit easier time attracting other talent. So we'll have to wait and see whether this change ends up changing things for Barcelona's fortunes going forward. At the end of the day, they're still one of the top two teams in Spain, and they're still going to, you know, print money out the ass. So it's, you know, I'm sure they still have a good youth system. They can promote these guys, which is kind of why I think you're a little bit puzzled, Kaz, that they would dig their heels in this situation. But I mean, he is one of the best players in the world, so it does make sense they would want to keep him. But
I'm not puzzled. I feel like it's one of those things. I sound puzzled, but I'm trying to make my point make sense, where I've seen teams do this in the past, and
it doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah, like I've seen a lot of teams do this in the past. Sometimes, very rarely, it works out. But you end up with a lot of these situations where you end up squandering this great talent because somebody was stubborn, right? And I'm just kind of the type of person, in my mindset, I'm like, you know what? We can't come to a mutual agreement anymore. And I understand the business aspect, where even keeping a dissatisfied superstar still sells a lot of merchandise and tickets. But man, I'm so much more for the marketing spin of finding a new person, especially in a sport like soccer, where you can just, you know, where you would definitely have the money for a team like Barcelona, and you could go out and get some up and coming superstar and just start postering his face everywhere. You know, it's not as hard as it is in maybe like football or another sport to definitely go out and get what you want, because in soccer you can literally go out and get what you want if you have the money for it.
Yeah. All right, maybe you're not that puzzled. Another soccer team, Angel City FC, or at least that's the official name now. That's for the Los Angeles NWSL team. They've picked up even more investors, so this is kind of like the cool hip celebrity investment team for if you want to get in on the ground floor of women's soccer. So like we got celebrities like a lot of the former women's national team players, Natalie Portman, those people, but also they've added Lindsey Vonn, Sophia Bush, James Corden, a couple other athletes as well, former Galaxy star Kobe Jones.
Is this a too many hands in the pot kind of situation?
It could be, but they do have a designated figurehead, Julie Ehrman, who is, she's going to be the one that acts as team president. So I think it's just maybe just a bunch of people pooling their money together. But I don't know, like the more, because I love the idea of millionaires banding together and coming up with enough money to buy a team that is hopefully worth billions someday. And like we see it in so many of the other sports, that it's like, it's mostly just, single billionaires that have so much money and decide to buy a team as like a plaything. The Steve Ballmers of the world, although he's an extreme example, but, you know, but it's mostly billionaires. So like, I like the idea of millionaires banding together, especially millionaire former athletes, the idea that like you can make enough money playing the sport that you can eventually own a team someday is
the,
good.
The
and
Michael
I feel
Jordan
like,
effect. The...
Yeah, like only Michael Jordan has been able to achieve that. I think Magic Johnson has been able to achieve like part ownership in other other teams that he's part owner of, the LA Sparks and the LA Dodgers. But and Patrick Mahomes has bought a stake in the Kansas City Royals. But you know, obviously Patrick Mahomes has just signed the richest contract ever. So like, it should be just those people. Even Kevin Garnett, who I think is, if you look up like the list of who has made the most money just playing basketball, period, Kevin Garnett is at the top of that list. Mm-hmm. If you don't count endorsements, and he's still like he's trying to find somebody to partner with in order to get into an NBA ownership group. So I like seeing conglomerates like this. However, the Sacramento Kings are like that, and there's a lot of feuding, a lot of leaking whenever things go bad. Like we start hearing like leaks from the minority owners about conflicts about this and conflicts about that, and it's like, you know, so when things are bad, I kind of do expect a lot of bullshit to start happening.
And that's my thing with these kind of situations, with the too many hands in the pot situations, right? Is I whether you're the person who put in $5 or $1, right? You feel like your value is equal to everyone else's, so you feel like your word is equal to everyone else's, and you feel like you should have a say in everything that happens when you really shouldn't, because if I somehow come across the graces to give money to a NASCAR team, right, and own part of or all of a NASCAR team, I am going to trust anyone else but myself to make day-to-day decisions, because guess what, I don't know shit about cars. And even if I am consider myself the greatest tennis player, basketball player, football player, whatever, I am not the greatest soccer player in the world. And even if I was the greatest soccer player in the world, I wasn't the greatest soccer, you know what I mean? Like there's all these other things that you are just not, that I think your dollar value should just live where it is. I am disappointed in Jerry Jones.
Jerry Jones is an example of a guy who tries to meddle in everything. He's the owner and general manager of that team effectively. Michael Jordan himself, like he's been able, when he's on the court, he can will his team to victory. When he's off the court and he's just trying to like run the team, he hasn't had quite so much success, and he can't apply the same. He can't apply his own determination to making that team successful.
A lot of the time, I think Jerry Jones and Michael Jordan, I think, kind of are cut from the same cloth for this problem. Is you feel like your mindset on certain things is so much greater than anyone else you can hire, that you short sight yourself on those decisions, right? You don't hire the coach who's going to tell you no. You don't hire the general manager who's going to tell you no, because you want the guy who's going to agree with you. But then the problem is, the guy who's going to agree with you and take that check is probably most of the time not the right person for that job.
Yeah. Diversity isn't just a buzzword. It's So in this ownership group, I mean, who knows? Like we're speculating, looking way ahead. Who knows who they're going to eventually hire to coach this team, to manage this team, and who they're going to get in the expansion draft, and all these things that have to happen for them before they start playing in 2022. But at least the money is there, and that's a pretty big concern for, women's soccer leagues, professional women's soccer leagues have folded multiple times in the U.S. So anytime somebody wants to throw more money into this pot, let's go ahead. If some of these ownership groups end up feuding and some people get bought out and stuff, and then they decide to go take their money to other teams, That's fine too. Just as long as people look at the sport and see it as something that is going to grow, something that is worth investing in, something where if you're, you know, Alexis Ohanian and Serena Williams, where you're going to give an ownership stake to your kid because you know, in 20 years, you think it's going to be worth a lot. So I'm glad there's more people trying to get in on this Los Angeles team. And hopefully we can start seeing some of the same things for other teams around the league as well, or some new teams popping up.
That'd be good. If it'll be good if it expands outward and doesn't just keep piling up in this one space.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk let's get to the roundup of baseball and the craziness that is baseball. So all in all, at the end of the day, the Dodgers are your world champions for the first time in
close to 30 years.
30 something years?
Since 1988, I believe. So
that's 37 years.
Yeah, so a pretty long time. And they've been close the last couple years. Most famously, or at least most egregiously, they lost to the Astros, the cheating Astros. So in a way, I feel like this is a little bit of redemption for that. They got the win that they should have gotten a couple years ago. Clayton Kershaw gets a little bit of redemption, and he gets to wipe away all those. All this talk about him not being great in the postseason. He had a fantastic postseason and a fantastic World Series in the two games that he pitched. And he was ready to come in and pitch some more if necessary. I think Dave Roberts gets a little bit of he gets a lot of criticism as well, but you know, now that he can add champion to his resume, then that kind of silences people a little bit. One fact I didn't know is that he's only the second Black manager to ever win a World Series, and also the first Asian manager to ever win a World Series. So that's kind of nice. I think this also, I mean, it certainly validates the Mookie Betts trade, which I think the Dodgers gave up collective high five for all the Black and Asian people on this podcast. I started doing this thing in one of our Discord channels, or one of the Discord channels that we frequent, where like I started tracking like all the Asian people in I guess physical sports, because if you add esports to this, then it's just like all Asian people.
It's okay, but JVZ. From what I see on Twitter, pretty much every Asian sports fan does this. So
it's fine. Yeah, I think most famously, like the Pablo Torre Mina Kimes skit, where they had like a shrine to like anybody and everybody that had like a shred of Asian heritage. But yeah, there's just not a lot of Asian figureheads in American sports. So every time one does show up, then we get super enthusiastic about it. Dave Roberts kind of moves up to the top of my power rankings for that. Kyler Murray is just below him, who is having a fantastic NFL season.
What about Eric Spoelstra, BZ?
Before Dave Roberts, he was at number five, and then Dave Roberts kind of leapfrogged to the top of the list, bumping Spoelstra to like number six because he didn't win the championship. So there's a lot of recency bias in these power rankings, but you know, I had G-Man Choi near the top because everybody was coming around to how cool G-Man Choi is and all of his spectacular plays that he was making at first base. And Naomi Osaka. I think that makes up most of the list. But you know, this week, if Tua Tagovailoa has a great first start, I think he can make his way onto the list. I've started tracking this because there are also like, it's a learning process for me too, because there are a lot of people that I didn't realize were Asian, like Juju Smith-Schuster. You know, and also like some people that like you don't quite realize. Well, I knew about Kyler Murray, but that's because we on this podcast have been tracking Kyler Murray since back when he was trying to decide whether he should play football or baseball. And so that was before the Heisman, before he was drafted number one overall. So even if he doesn't know who we are, I consider him a friend of the show. I'm tracking these in the power rankings. It's just a nice fun little thing to do for me to get in a little bit more touch with my heritage. It's not just the Jeremy Lins of the world that are
famous. Shout out to Jeremy Lin. Good, but yeah, good Knicks run. Fucking the last, literally the last good Knicks run we had.
Hallowed be thy name, where we always stand for Jeremy Lin. But all right, back to baseball. This Mookie Betts trade, it just looks even worse in hindsight for the Boston Red Sox to give up one of the best players in baseball. And it seems like they didn't get all that much in return. And then the guy you give up goes and wins yet another World Series for another team. And it just seemed like all postseason long.
But
I was watching Mookie Betts hit doubles over and over again, and him doing his little I don't even know what kind of dance that is, but it's like it looks like he's slapping butts whenever he hits second base. It just feels like I've.
So for me, this is one of those things that circles back around to the comment I had earlier, where it's sometimes you have to give up on a good thing because it just doesn't work in the situation that it's in, you know? And
he, all they had to do is pay him more. this kind of goes back to the other thing you said, where like when you have the money to do it, you should do it. I mean,
oh, yes, okay.
Like, there's a big contrast between these two teams that made the World Series. The Dodgers can spend money. The Tampa Bay Rays, they have traditionally chosen not to, and they've been very creative about how they do it. But at the end of the day, like when you have talented people, you should try to spend the money to keep them. And that's what's been so frustrating being an A's fan. And that's what I imagine is somewhat frustrating being a Tampa Bay Rays fan. If those people are watching their good players sign with other teams after they become good, maybe the Rays don't have to be so creative about how they manage their lineups, how they fuck around with their pitching, how they do all that stuff. If they can just keep their good pitchers or keep their good batters or whatever.
So you say that, but there's a person out there who's looking at it right now and they're like, yeah, but look how far they made it.
Yeah. But the thing is, like when you compare that to Boston, when you compare that to the Red Sox, one of the most storied franchises in Major League Baseball and one of the richest, then watching them let a guy like Mookie Betts go is, a guy that can be a cornerstone of their franchise for the next. I think he signed a 13-year contract with the, a 12-year contract with the Dodgers. Letting a guy like that go, like, definitely does not sit well when you know your team is rich enough to handle this. I've said before, like the baseball luxury tax is weak as shit. So I hate it when any team decides to cheap out, especially the rich ones like the Yankees and the Dodgers. And even I would say the last couple years, I think the Dodgers were trying to lower their payroll a little bit, which like to me sounds like, no, why? Like just, like it's not going to cost you that much to spend more like it does in the NBA. So, I don't know, just baseball owners are cheap and I hate it. I hate that there's no minimum salary floor that they have to hit. Because then you get so many teams that just try to do more with less. And I want to see teams try to do more with a little bit more pay more money to their athletes instead of trying to race to the bottom. even if they find creative ways to race to the bottom and still be competitive. So, but I mean, good on the Rays for getting there this far. Part of how they've done that is being able to is managing their pitching time.
Now, JVZ,
their starters don't go too far. Yeah, what's up?
Now, you on our podcast have been the biggest proprietor of the Tampa Bay Rays and the way they manage their pitching staff. Now, I want you to answer this for the court, the court of public opinion, all right, for all of our listeners across sports odds and ends land. In this decisive Game 6 of the World Series, Blake Snell, the ace starting pitcher, former Cy Young winner, he was pitching pretty well. And then the manager pulled him. And for the longest time, the Tampa Bay Rays seemed to go with the model of the opening pitcher with varying degrees of varying pitchers. How did you feel about this decision when it happened?
Okay, I'm going to sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I fucking hated it. And it's, you know, like I've been, while I do enjoy the Rays' creativity, because I think we're always, like, baseball has kind of been the same way for such a long time. And we're seeing, like, a lot of different new strategies come up. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're good for, and we talk about this all the time when we talk about analytics, sometimes they're good for the regular season, for a 162-game regular season. And but then the playoffs are different because you're playing the same team over and over again. And you're playing better teams. And in this case, if you're in the World Series, you are playing the literal best team from the other conference. And when you got a guy out there that is successful, and I said the same thing when the Dodgers pulled Clayton Kershaw early the day before. It's like, I feel like you got to ride some of these guys until they show cracks. And Blake Snell wasn't showing any cracks. Like, the guys that were up next to bat, even though that was the meaty part of the Dodgers lineup, those guys were scared of him. And they said in the interviews afterwards, like, they were struggling trying to hit his pitches. They couldn't see what he was doing. And so they were happy when this pitching change happened, and it backfired immediately. And yeah, I get the logic for why they did it. They don't want to let any batter on the Dodgers see the same pitcher more than twice, because they think, like, you know, the third time, that's when they can kind of figure out what they're trying to do with their pitches. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's like, okay, maybe he faces, I think he was about to face Mookie Betts. And so maybe he faces Mookie Betts and Mookie Betts gets a hit. And maybe then that's when you start pulling him. But until they start showing cracks, I don't think you should pull him. Like, the day before, Clayton Kershaw threw two pitches and got two outs, and Dave Roberts came out and pulled him. And everybody was mad about it, and it didn't backfire on them because I think Dustin May came in and got a bunch of outs right afterwards. But in that case, to me, like, I don't understand the logic of, like, two pitches ago, you were willing to throw this guy out there and see what he had, and then two pitches later, he's not good enough anymore. Two successful pitches, wildly successful pitches, as efficient as a pitcher could possibly be. So, like, why pull him then? I don't know. To me, the playoffs seems like that's the time when you let the managers manage and let them make exceptions to the analytics, because the playoffs is where the exceptions happen. I know it feels like you should ride the strategy that got you to where you are now, but the strategy designed to get you to where you are now is based off of trying to keep everybody fresh. And you don't need to keep everybody fresh in the World Series because you don't have games after this. And, you know, the Rays were in a situation where if they lost this game, that was it. And they still chose to pull the guy that was keeping them in this game. So it's, I mean, keeping pitchers fresh is nice. Clayton Kershaw was warming up in the bullpen. but you know, you could have let him get one more out, you know, and then brought Dustin May in after after the end of the inning. It almost seems like the times where they've chosen to pull these guys, that there's logic behind it, but it almost feels like arbitrary logic, if that oxymoron makes any sense. And if there's any time to deviate from the sabermetrics, the World Series is that time. Like, you got to play it situational. And in this case, I think they stuck to their guns and took their best weapon off the board. I don't know. It feels like I'm parroting what everybody else has said immediately after this happened. I do feel that way. And as much as a proponent as I am with analytics, and as much as I joke about nine pitchers, nine innings, it's in this case, I would have liked to have seen this pitcher go another inning or two. I have to take the L on that one. All right. This baseball season.
Look, let's just get into it. Some people did some dumb shit, okay?
All right.
First of all, let's start with, let's keep it on the field. One of the players got a positive COVID test and was pulled from the game. And then when team one decided, I'm going to go celebrate with the boys. Yep. And didn't have a mask on.
He came out and celebrated on the field mostly with a mask on, but then like for team pictures and stuff, and pictures with the trophy, like he pulled his mask down. The weird thing is like he was sitting right next to Dave Roberts, who is, I believe, a Hodgkin's lymphoma survivor. He obviously was not socially distanced from the rest of his team during the team photos. So you basically got, a potentially a super spreader out there just celebrating with a known guy, somebody who knows he had a positive test. I think there was questions as this was happening, like were some of these tests inconclusive, or could this have been a false positive? No, this was a confirmed positive test. And Justin Turner is also a guy earlier in the season who was very vocal about how well the Dodgers were following the rules and how other teams needed to do a better job of following the rules, because they were going to fuck it up for everybody else if they didn't. And when it came time for Justin Turner to apply those rules to himself, he chose not to do that. And he put his, not just his teammates at risk, but their families who were out there as well, all the staff who was out there as well. He put all of them at risk just so that he could have fun celebrating. And obviously this is a moment that he's been working towards for a long time and all that. But like, everybody has had to make tough decisions in this COVID climate. And so are you willing to make a tough decision to forego something for yourself for the greater good? And just in Justin Turner's case, I think he showed that he very clearly wasn't. There's documented video evidence, photographic evidence of how little he cares about the rules now, that'll live on forever. MLB's protocols, it kind of calls into question that as well. Like, how is a positive test coming in the middle of the game? So if you dig into it, like, there is a little bit of it takes some time. They're testing in Texas where they're playing, and they're shipping their tests off to a lab in Utah, and they're trying to get it done as fast as possible. But basically his test from yesterday, or sorry, the day before the game, was finally tested, and it came back inconclusive. And so that's what caused them to expedite the next test. And that one was confirmed positive. Um, so basically they found out that that second test was confirmed positive in the middle of like the seventh inning. So that's when they had to go and pull him from the game. And so just a very weird situation to end the season. Like,
and I've had these discussions because, you know, I let myself be known as a gentleman who likes sports, and people have come up and asked me like, how is this a thing? How did this happen? Yada, yada, yada. And I'm just like, baseball's just bad, man. Like, they're just bad. They're really, really bad at people management, like, on a day-to-day basis. Whereas, once again, our shining stars, the NBA and the WNBA, like, and I understand, you know what, maybe for something like the NBA, it's a little bit easier to do a bubble. I still feel like baseball is one of those things that could have done a bubble, but whatever, man.
Yeah. Well, so they technically were in a bubble. So that's also the weird thing about this. And,
true.
They were in a bubble for the playoffs. And so, like, how did Justin Turner test positive? And, like, who gave it to him? Where did he get it from? Did he violate any protocols on the way to doing that? That'll have to, we'll have to wait and see on that for investigations to come forward. But yeah, this very much looks like, they got through the season. Like, it was hard enough getting through the season. And once they got through, they didn't give a shit about anything else. And, you know, fuck the rules at this point. Like, we've crowned a champion. We got our money. Even though it was an abbreviated season, we did it, guys. Mission accomplished. We're done. And who gives a shit if anybody gets sick now because the season is over? That's really what it feels like. And from a Major League Baseball perspective, obviously, like, if a grown man like Justin Turner is just that determined to get out there, I'm not of the mindset of, like, you got to handcuff this guy to a pipe in the stadium or something so that he can't run out there with his teammates. Like, at some point you got to put the blame on the individual for being a shithead. But
Definitely.
Most, you know, and like, the people that would get paid to restrain him obviously aren't going to be aren't getting paid enough to deal with a COVID positive athlete trying to that is determined to break the rules. So there's only so much that they could have done in that situation, but it's still just a really bad look. And I'm under no illusions that the people in charge, the owners in charge of baseball, are they don't really care about anything else besides the money, and they got their money and now they're done. And and whatever the fallout ends up being, we'll just have to deal with that and then see what happens next year. We got one more season before we got a work stoppage. So that's
and I need the city of LA in general to re-fucking relax.
Yeah, there. So I don't know. Act like you've been there before.
I know it's been a long time.
Or was like 2 weeks ago when the Lakers won.
But you know how different,
like, they should have gotten it out of their system then. I think that Lakers celebration has been has already been advertised as a super spreader event. So, like, maybe let's not throw another super spreader event. They went out and got even more rowdy. Cars got lit on fire. Like,
In a state that's already on fire.
In a state that's already on fire. It's like,
don't light shit on fire when your state's already on fire, man.
It's
like, fuck, man. I mean,
yeah. So this is why I hate LA teams. It's not necessarily a team. Sometimes, like,
I'm All right, let's talk a little bit about basketball. I'm saving a lot of my basketball kind of thoughts. We're going to try to do something later on and talk in depth, but let's hit some quick things. So the Utah Jazz franchise has been sold to is this a one person thing, or is this because I know Ryan Smith is the majority owner now, but is there
I don't know if they have minority ownership, but at least the controlling stake has been sold to Ryan Smith, the founder of Qualtrics. I believe everything has been sold, including the arena, because it's $1.6 billion, which, like, this, the Utah Jazz are a small market team. It's very similar to Sacramento in the sense that, at least of the very, very large sports. So, like, I'm kind of like excluding the MLS here, but like basketball is kind of the only game in town. There's no football team, there's no baseball team, and no hockey team. The Utah Jazz are a small market team, and if that team is selling for $1.6 billion, then that bodes very well for the value of other teams. And I think that's been a part of like why NBA franchises have skyrocketed in value, because the Sacramento Kings sold for a hefty amount. The Milwaukee Bucks sold for a hefty amount. Even the New Orleans Hornets, when they were having trouble finding ownership, when they sold, they eventually sold for a hefty amount. You know, all the small teams are being sold for a lot. On top of that, you got the Houston Rockets, who sold for, who are one of the richer teams, who sold for a pretty big amount, and the LA Clippers, who I think were $2 billion at the time that Steve Ballmer came in and bought them. These teams are skyrocketing in value, and so it's not just NFL teams anymore that are super valuable. It's NBA teams are starting to move up those ranks as well. Ryan Smith himself is a lifelong Utah Jazz fan, so I think every time a team gets sold, you worry about, you know, is this owner going to try to move the team or not? And so I don't think Jazz fans have to worry about that. They just have to worry about whether he's going to be a good owner or not. He bought it from the Miller family, Gail Miller, who I think they've been in charge of the team for like, you know, 30 some years or so. And I guess, fun fact, during the Miller's tenure, only the San Antonio Spurs have had a better winning percentage than the Utah Jazz. That's regular season winning percentage, because the Utah Jazz, they had two NBA Finals runs and all those great years with Karl Malone and John Stockton. But, you know, never could get a championship out of those years, but they came close.
I still think those were good teams. They just were kind of came in a bad run.
They ran into Michael Jordan. That's the only issue. During the Miller's tenure, they won nearly 60% of their games. So I think, you know, there's Malone and Stockton, and then, you know, Carlos Boozer and Darren Williams, and most recently Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell. I think they've always found a way to get success despite being in a small market. So I think that's something that can be applauded, and so hopefully under new ownership they can continue that tradition. Some coaching changes, or coaching hires, I would say. Like, all these jobs were vacant, but the New Orleans Hornets hired Stan Van Gundy, the Houston Rockets hired Stephen Silas, and
I'm not mad about that,
and the Indiana Pacers hired Nate Bjorkgren, who was an assistant for Nick Nurse in Toronto. I don't know anything about Nick Bjorkgren, but I think the Toronto Raptors are at the point where, you know, they won their championship last year. Now everybody's going to raid their staff.
That's what I was going to say. It's one of those things, you're getting hired because of who you worked for, not necessarily what you did, which sometimes isn't necessarily bad, right? Because a lot of times it is the staff around people. And I think even to a certain degree, with the Raptors being able to make it to the playoffs a second time, even without the giant star that they had, who allowed them to not only make it to the playoffs, but then win a championship. So for them to be able to make it there again, missing that big amount of production, one goes to show kind of, I think, the smart of Nick Nurse. He was being already praised a lot for being a good coach, but his staffing choices were also being praised. So it's one of those things, you do get praised for who you work for, but now you have to go and show that you can actually do those things. that's why it kind of goes on my list. Stan Van Gundy at this point to me is, I don't understand why people keep giving him a job.
Well, so I think DJM has the most recent experience with the Stan Van Gundy experience. but he was also, he was coach and general manager in Detroit.
In this case, with New Orleans, he will only be the head coach. He will not be general manager, president of basketball operations. And over Stan Van Gundy's history, his best work has been with younger teams. And the New Orleans Pelicans are a younger team. So by that logic, it makes sense. As long as they're not letting Stan make personnel decisions, it might work.
Yeah, and I think Stan Van Gundy kind of gets forgotten as maybe one of the... I know Daryl Morey is, you know, kind of the three-pointer, the three-point king when it comes to analytics around that. But Stan Van Gundy kind of did the first, you know, one big guy in the middle, Dwight Howard, and then just a bunch of four other shooters around the three-point line. And so he, that brought the Orlando Magic all the way to the NBA Finals, where they lost to the Lakers. He was kind of a pioneer for that. Now they got, you know, their big guy in the middle, Zion Williamson, and some other talented players around the perimeter. So maybe you can try to do the same thing there. Maybe obviously with some adjustments to adjust for the modern NBA, but I think at the very least it's a solid hire. Who knows whether it's going to get him a championship or not, but he's a guy who has had success wherever he went, even in Detroit. I would say I think part of the problem with his tenure in Detroit was that he had a little bit of success and not it seemed like the Pistons were, you know, the playoff team, like always the eight seed every year, so you couldn't really rebuild because you're always making the playoffs, but you were never good enough to get any further than that. And so as part of the rebuilding, get rid of the coach that is making your team too good, and switch things up. But now I think the Pelicans are kind of at that same level, but they need a push to get better, and so hopefully Stan Van Gundy can do that for them.
Yeah,
because they have a good young talent, and Zion Williamson was one of the most anticipated rookies to come into the league for a long time, and because of injuries, he didn't get to show that a lot. So hopefully, he can make waves next year. So we brought up Daryl Morey's name, and I think the last show we had was the one where he stepped down, and it only took like a week and a half for him to get a new job.
Didn't he also say he was done with?
Yeah, he said he was stepping down for family, but I think he was stepping down to get away from the Rockets.
Which is what we said, and we said it sounded like one of those things where you're trying to be nice, and you really know you, they were like, "Look, either you go, or we make you go." So you went, "Oh, I want to spend time with my family." Yada yada yada. They didn't even wait like. They didn't even give us a month. They didn't even give us like a good 4 month little kind of hiatus. No, he was just straight up out here filling out job applications. But yeah, he's gonna be the guy over in Philadelphia now.
I think even I don't know if this was the team getting rid of him as much as him wanting to get away from the team, because it. Definitely seems like, I mean, we talked to death about how bleak the Rockets' future looks going forward. So there's that, and then dealing with a new owner that everybody seems to hate. His lead assistant is gone. His head coach is gone.
Look, I ain't gonna lie to you. At this point, the Rockets are on my blow up list.
Here's the thing. People don't take a job with the Sacramento Kings unless you really hate your old job. And Daryl Morey's lead assistant was like, he wanted that job with the Sacramento Kings. So that was, to me, it was like, wait, why would a guy leave working for Daryl Morey to come work for the Kings? And it's because he hated the people above Daryl Morey, and and so, you know, that's why Mike D'Antoni left. That's why, and I think that's, you know, why Daryl Morey is wanted to leave as well. So now he gets a, I don't know if it's a better job, because we've also talked about how much Philadelphia is struggling, and is the process over? Strangely enough, the process was started by one of his proteges, Sam Hinkie. So now he gets to come in. Elton Brand is still technically the general manager of that team. Morey is going to get a job above him, and Brand is going to stick around. So I think a lot of the complaints about Brand was due to his inexperience. So now he has, you know, maybe one of the most experienced general managers working above him, kind of cutting him off at the knees. But also, if he chooses to stick around, it's an opportunity for him to learn and maybe grow into the role that some people think he was given a little bit too early. But now that a guy who is kind of a champion for shooting more threes has been brought into town, now everybody's staring at Ben Simmons, who absolutely refuses to shoot threes, and wondering, like, okay, does this mean Ben Simmons is getting traded? What is this going to change for the makeup of the Philadelphia 76ers, who we've already talked about how maybe they need to blow this up, maybe the process is over? So it's going to be a big, this is probably the most intriguing wait and see scenario for the NBA right now, because this is still a team with a lot of talent on it. It just seems like they've maxed that talent out, but they've brought in, I mean, if you were to claim that the coach was the problem, they brought in Doc Rivers, one of the, at least one of the most respected coaches in the league. They've also added, several high profile assistants to his staff as well. So I think, unless there's personality clashes, I think coaching talent is not going to be a problem next year. It's, you know, and on top of that, they've got the front office to maybe compete long-term, and maybe a front office that is capable of salvaging what they have now, and turning it into something good. So, very intriguing situation over in Philadelphia now. I'm glad the East is getting more talent, even if it's front office talent.
I am definitely, I think overall, one of my big things is I want to see the Eastern Conference be respected again in basketball. I think it's been a while. I don't count any of the LeBron time.
You can't necessarily count the team at the top, because the team at the top is always going to be good. But I think, I think it's this year's playoffs was like the first time where you could see like we've got like four Eastern Conference teams that are just slugging it out with each other. Yeah. And that was fun to see, rather than just one team bulldozing their way to the finals to lose to LeBron eventually. I think we could clearly see that the Lakers were like a step above, but at least they weren't that far above. The East is slowly recovering, and hopefully we can get balanced conferences soon, because trying to make the playoffs in the West when your team sucks really sucks. And so I'd like some of that talent to flow east. So as far as like plans for the upcoming season right now, those are still in flux. We know the NHL is targeting like New Year's Day for their start date, which is kind of soon. The NBA is targeting even earlier. They're trying to go for December 22nd so that they can have a Christmas Day game.
I don't know, man, because that
it's very soon.
I think it's just too soon.
To keep in mind, so we're in end of October right now, October 29th. The NBA draft, I believe, is mid-November. I think it's I want to say it's the 11th, but that's Veterans Day, so I don't know if they would normally do a draft on Veterans Day. But the draft is going to be mid-November, and then they're going to have like a month before the regular season starts. So that means that you got to do training camp and preseason before then.
Yeah,
November 18th is when the NBA draft is. Thank you, Puck.
One of the biggest spectacles of the NBA is the NBA offseason.
Yes.
Like, if you are an NBA fan, one of the biggest spectacles for you is the NBA offseason. Yeah. It's where you get to arm, like, everybody gets to automatically assume that everyone is going to go somewhere, somehow, some way. Like it is the weirdest speculations happen, and sometimes some of them come true.
And sometimes they come out of nowhere, like Kawhi Leonard tampering and dragging Paul George out of Oklahoma City and surprising everybody when it happens. It's nuts, and usually a lot of stuff happens in a very short span of time. Normally we have time to let it breathe, we'll do summer league, and then we'll do the draft, and then we'll do summer league for a couple months, and then NBA free agency, and then and then let it breathe for a couple months, and then training camp. And then everybody can get excited for the season. But now it's like they're cramming all that into about a month, and the season just ended. So who knows what this is going to do to, and also they're trying to cram the regular season into a 72 game season so that they can finish before the Olympics start. So that way they're not competing with the Olympics for eyeballs. Because we've seen like how much every sport has struggled with ratings while all the sports are trying to compete at the same time right now. They're trying to do the Christmas Day stuff because Christmas Day has normally been a day that has been reserved for the NBA. And that's a day where they know they're not going to have to compete with the NFL. So that's why they want the December 22nd start. I think their backup plan is to start Martin Luther King Day in January. So, but I think there were reports that they could recoup $500 million or so in revenue if they were to start a little bit earlier. So, as always, it's all about the money, We covered like all the financial worries that all sports are having to go through last week. This is a part of that. This is a part of the negotiations. I think the players are they're pushing back on this November 22nd start date, or sorry, the December 22nd start date. They still have a lot to negotiate over that, but we'll see what they end up having to come up with. But it looks like they want to get basketball started up again very, very soon. So very short off seasons. I think we're going to be in a period here where it's just the NFL and soccer, European soccer, and the remainder of the F1 season for a while. But pretty soon we'll get the NHL and the NBA back. It looks like we're shifting a little bit back towards normalcy when it comes to at least the season's coming back to normal. But when that Olympic start date was announced and they said we're doing this with or without COVID a couple months ago, I was surprised. But I didn't realize how much of an effect it would have on other sports like the NBA. So they're going to try to cram a 72 game season in before then. Who knows how it goes. Maybe a bunch of people are going to get injured this year.
Yeah. It's just so weird, but yeah, no, it's just, I just can't fathom the NBA or anything starting that quickly. And not giving players enough time to rest and recuperate.
You also have to keep in mind there's, I think, 8 teams that have been resting since March.
Yeah.
It's, but yeah, they do need like a month to get back up to speed.
Yeah.
But yeah, we haven't seen Steph Curry play basketball since March. that's one thing to keep in mind. And we haven't seen Kevin Durant play basketball for 2 years now. So it's, you know, there are some players that are, that have been pretty well rested. It's basically only the Lakers and the Heat that are coming off of a month rest, and the Lakers don't really need any more advantages. So, you know, anything that knocks them down a peg, I'm all for. But yeah, the teams that did make the playoffs and made deep playoff runs are going to have to get a little bit creative for how they start the season. But otherwise, it's, I don't know. It'll be interesting. Wait and see. All right. Our two NFL stories this week are some oddities. Cowboys defensive coordinator Mike Nolan, who is probably going to get fired by the end of the season because the Cowboys defense has been terrible.
Obviously.
Historically terrible. Had an incident at his latest press conference where he had to leave the press conference because he got Tabasco sauce in his eye. He was in the middle of answering a question and just rubbed his eye and with his finger, and then had to tail off and had to tell everybody else that his eye was burning and left. We got a video of that in our show notes if you want to take a look at that. Good job, Mike Nolan. He used to be the coach of the 49ers, and his defenses were just as bad then as they are now. So yeah, good luck on that, Mike Nolan. He did return to the press conference and eventually completed it, but another weird incident from the
week. I got paint in my eye, and that took me like 30 seconds to figure out, man.
Well, yeah, I mean, burning eyes is rough. I've heard it from other people before. Once you get hot sauce in your eyes,
try getting another thick ass paint in your eye. That shit hurt, bro. Yeah, it's not fun, man.
It's COVID season, so I mean, it's been COVID season for a long time. But like, you know, wash your hands, don't touch your face. Like, that's one thing that we've learned. I know it's hard to actually follow that sometimes, but that's another reason to not touch your face, just in case you have Tabasco sauce on your finger. Just always watch out for that. All right. I want to talk about Daniel Jones.
Sure.
Because he had one of the most amazing plays that I have ever seen. The highest of highs, the lowest of lows, but probably not that low. He ripped off I always love seeing quarterbacks run. Mm-hmm. It's becoming more and more of a part of modern offenses nowadays. You got the Lamar Jacksons of the world. I know we see it a lot more in college because you got option plays and stuff that are more effective in college than they are in the NFL when defensive athletes are kind of freaks. But Daniel Jones is a guy that doesn't necessarily strike me as an athletic quarterback. And I know there's some racial connotations to that, and I fully admit that I might feel some of that. But also part of it is that he very much looks like Eli Manning, who very much was not a guy that you would expect to run at all. So when Daniel Jones DJM wants me to acknowledge the other white quarterbacks in the NFL that are very prolific runners, the guys like Josh Allen, there are some other names that I'm blanking on, but like for me as a 49ers fan, you know, Joe Montana and Steve Young were also, and Jeff Garcia were very prolific, elusive quarterbacks. But they weren't necessarily guys where, like, once they passed the line of scrimmage on a run, you would expect them to blow past the field. There's actually very few runners in the NFL in general where you could actually see the gap between them and the people chasing them increase. And that's what I saw with Daniel Jones this week. He got past the line of scrimmage and he had tons of space, and I expected everybody to catch up to him, but he accelerated and he increased that gap, and it was one of the most impressive things that I've ever seen. And then he tripped 20 yards before the end zone, And it was just a perfect encapsulation of the NFC East as an entire division this season. Just anytime there's a high, there's a low that follows it. But then there was a high after that. They were able to score the touchdown anyway, so no big deal. But
yeah, I think it's one of those things. I think it was even unexpected for himself, right? Like you know, you can do a thing, right? He knew he could get yards. I don't think even in his head he knew he was going to go that far, right?
He hit 22 miles an hour on that run, which is faster than any quarterback has ever run since they started tracking the stat. And any quarterback, I mean, all of Lamar Jackson's runs from last year were slower than Daniel Jones, or at least the top speed in all those runs that Lamar Jackson ripped off last year, all his open field runs from last year. You know, Deshaun Watson, all those other guys, none of them ran as fast as Daniel Jones did on that run. And effectively he ran faster than his own body could handle. And that's what did him in.
Because I think for guys who do it and I'm not even going to say names, I'm not even going to put specifics to it, right? I think for guys who do it on a consistent basis, they understand pace more than a guy who does it every once in a while.
Yeah.
So he breaks that plane. He does the head check. Who's close to me, right? He has a guy close enough behind him to tell you, hey, nobody's behind you, keep going. I don't think he knows how to pace down. You know what I mean? Whereas like some of the other guys you mentioned, they know how to pace down once they've broken a certain plane to kind of save themselves for the next play or just in general. Just like I can start to slow down now. I don't have to keep going full gusto. I think in his mind, this isn't something he does every day. It's not, oh, I can slow down now and just cross the plane. It's, oh shit, I got to keep running. You know, like, yeah.
So, I mean, part of what I love about these plays is just usually they're incredibly very well designed. You know, for one person to have that much open space, like something strategically went wrong on the defensive end, but also something strategically went very right on the offensive end.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good sell, right? Because I think what I just said is what it is for the defense. Okay, Daniel Jones has made a few runs here or there, but they haven't looked like Lamar Jackson's runs or Kyler Murray's or Patrick Mahomes kind of things. So it's like, cool. If he sells this on the fake, we could probably catch him.
Yeah.
But
and it's probably good for a first down.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
I don't think one, if you go and look at it, the whole defense sold on that fake.
Yeah.
They sold. Like they were all going in the opposite direction when he broke the plane of the offensive and defensive line. They were still going in the other direction. Like that's how good of a sell it was, because it is one of those things you don't expect it. You're not looking for that. So they all sold on the run hard, real hard. And he took off. And I still think it's I have not been watching Giants games because they have been rather disappointing. Initially when I saw it come across, I was like, okay, like, and everybody was like, oh my God, is this worse than like whatever? Or is this like the most embarrassing thing that happened?
This wasn't like butt fumble bad.
Yeah, and then I went and looked at it, and I was like, what do you mean? That's still a great fucking play. Yeah, like even before the 22, you know, like the fastest pace a quarterback has set, I was like, yo, that's still a great fucking play. I've seen running backs make that play trip and fall, and it's still a great fucking play. Like,
as a 49ers fan, I've seen years of Frank Gore ripping off long runs and getting caught from behind just before the end zone. And now in this case, you know, like he tripped up his own feet, and so it looks bad. And the fact that all his teammates were celebrating at the time that he tripped, that makes it look a little bit worse. But the everything up until that point was incredibly impressive.
Super impressive, unexpected things. Fucking DK Metcalf running and catching a guy off of an interception, like a wide receiver chasing a guy down and tackling him to save a touchdown. That is impressive. I mean, not really. You would expect a wide receiver to have that kind of pace, I think.
I got a little bit of clout on Twitter for saying that that was Daniel Jones' speed. I was able to jump in on that. But plays where a guy just completely outpaces everybody else on the field, those are incredibly impressive. And so in this case, that was Daniel Jones. It came from an unexpected source for me, but I'm starting to feel like we should learn to expect it more, because there are very few quarterbacks in the NFL now that are not this athletic. I feel like everybody has to be able to run at least a little bit. And are the days of Peyton and Eli Manning, where they just sit in the pocket and hope everybody else protects them. Like, all these guys are elusive now. All these guys can buy you a first down when the play breaks down. And so I hope teams try to take advantage of that more. The athletic white quarterback has always been a thing in the NFL. I hope it gets more respect.
I think what it is we're coming off the era where some of the guys who were these athletic quarterbacks that everybody wanted, right? Because athletic quarterbacks have kind of always been a thing. It's kind of been a here or there, or a very elite kind of thing, you know, a Michael Vick type person. But I think what it is for the athletic quarterback, because I think Michael Vick is a special kind of point in history of the football timeline for that, because not only did he have the athleticism, he had the arm talent and the football IQ, right? And I think it always came down to, we'll take two of those three things over looking for all three of those things, right? You generally, a lot of the guys sometimes had the arm talent and the athleticism, but not the football IQ. I think for a long time, people looked mostly for the football IQ and the arm talent. But I think we're getting to a point now where people can start to expect to look for all three.
Yeah. I don't know if Daniel Jones has all three.
No. I think he's lacking on maybe all of those fronts, but that's me being a nasty Giants fan right now. But it's you know, he has some intangibles. Yeah, I think
the floor is higher, I think. Or not the floor, but the bare minimum for what you expect out of your quarterback. The variety you expect out of your quarterback is higher now, as offenses start to change and get a little bit more advanced, and analytics comes into play as well. So Josh Allen, DJ brought up Josh Allen, and I think the strides that he's made recently, DJM has been on the Josh Allen train for a long time, but I think he's made massive jumps every single season, every single off season. So now we're starting to see that. We're starting to see like a lot out of Ryan Tannehill, who is in a good situation in Tennessee. We're seeing a lot from the young quarterbacks that have come into the league as well. Getting off and running right away, like the Kyler Murrays of the world.
I think one of the other things is the last time people kind of looked for the athletic smart quarterback, a lot of those guys tended to be a little bit more injury prone because they relied on their athleticism a little too much in college.
Michael Vick was just always broken in half.
But he held out.
Is like the poster child of that.
Because he held out, I think, a lot longer. Like Michael Vick, even with the injuries, he still played a lot more than I think you ended up getting from people like RG3 or Terrell Pryor or some of these other names that I'm thinking of were just bad. But RG3 and Terrell Pryor are kind of the two names that come to mind.
Guys, not one mention. How dare you both? Okay. Not one mention of Aaron Rodgers.
That's fair. That is very fair. But I think Aaron Rodgers' arm talent just eclipses so much of his other skills yeah. that we kind of forget. But he is incredibly difficult to
tackle.
Like I put him under elusive because you normally don't see him rip off long runs. But to me, like there's a difference between an elusive quarterback and a quarterback that you actually design run plays around. Mm-hmm. And so like I put Russell Wilson in the elusive category. I put Patrick Mahomes in the elusive category, but I put Colin Kaepernick and Lamar Jackson in the category of quarterbacks that you actually design runs for, because you know they can rip off a 70-yard run in the middle of a game when nobody expects it. Or even if everybody does expect it, they can still do it. And so maybe we got to put Daniel Jones in that category as well, if the plays are designed well enough.
Yeah. Tell him, man, bring the option to the NFL.
But yeah, Aaron Rodgers does not get enough credit for being as elusive as he is. Ben Roethlisberger, I think, he's under elusive, but you would never design a run play for Ben Roethlisberger.
No, I think the thing with him though, I think, no disrespect, but I think kind of the Big Ben is kind of a thing. I think,
he is a big dude, but like he's
a big boy.
But yeah, he's elusive.
Yes,
and he's and on top of being elusive, he's a big guy, so that makes him hard to take down sometimes. But yeah, he's definitely a guy that can buy time with his feet. Michael Vick was both. So that's why, at least from a football standpoint, Michael Vick is always legendary in everybody's minds. And from a Madden standpoint, he was unstoppable. And it's only from a physical injury standpoint and a killing dogs in a spare time standpoint that derailed his career. Mm. Mad props to Daniel Jones. I came into this wanting to make fun of him, but I'm glad that we
can still make fun of the Giants because one of the players has goddamn COVID and they're probably going to be shut down. So,
all right.
Kaz, as mm-hmm. the Giants fan, I just thought of a nickname for Daniel Jones. Instead of Danny Dimes, given his running ability, should we call him Danny Dust?
Yeah, I think you got to do it more than I think it has to be a little more consistent to earn a nickname like that.
Okay. Take it home.
Before that, the New York Giants are only 1.5 games behind the division lead in the NFC East. So still in it.
God, fucking so bad. Okay, I'm done.
The Eagles are 2-4-1, and they're on top. The Giants are 1-6. So
how did we get? How did this area get so bad? But I fucking can't. I can't fathom. I'm gonna have an aneurysm. All right, I'm gonna end the show. Thank you for listening to this show, Sports Haws and Ends, which somehow, some way, even on the nicest of show, finds ways to give me an aneurysm. Make sure you check us all out individually on Twitter, or you can check out the show as well. Which we're trying to use the show Twitter a little bit more, so make sure you respond to that so that we are reminded to use it. Sports Odds Ends at Twitter.com or on Twitter.com. I am at King Kaz. JVZ is at JVZ. DJM is Call Me DJM. You can check out the show's website, sportsoddsandends.com. And if you're feeling a little bit like giving, you can go on over to patreon.com/sportsoddsandends and you can give us a little bit, help us out with the show, help us out with all the things around here. And even if you don't, we love you anyway. So thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. And we'll catch you next time.